This is a free speech radio news special for Juneteenth, June 19, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. The debt owed to African Americans to come before the U.S. House. We talk with the reparations bill's author, Congressman John Conyers. More than 30 years after the Jim Crow laws of segregation were abolished, we go to the most segregated suburb in America. And we pay tribute to award-winning poet and UC Berkeley professor June Jordan, who died of breast cancer last week. But first, these news headlines.
President Bush today proposed spending $500 million to keep mothers in eight African countries and the Caribbean from passing the AIDS virus to their babies. Meanwhile, a new UN report blames globalization for widening poverty and calls on rich nations to sharply boost aid to the third world. Susan Wood has more from the United Nations.
The number of people living on less than $1 a day has doubled over the past 30 years to reach 307 million. And will jump to 420 million by 2015 if current trends continue, according to the UN Conference on Trade and Development. UNCTAD's Least Developed Countries report says globalization has not led to economic growth, but has in fact tightened what it calls the international poverty trap by lowering barriers to trade and foreign investment. The agency has long called for a doubling of international aid to the 49 poorest countries. Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs, speaking at a UN news conference, dismissed what he termed the rhetoric that trade alone can overcome poverty and called on Washington to increase assistance for projects to provide education and clean water and fight AIDS. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on White-Collar Crime held a hearing today on cracking down on white-collar criminals. From Washington, Ellen Ratner reports.
In the wake of some recent corporate accounting scandals that have shaken the financial market, many are calling for tougher penalties. For example, critics say a car stolen and driven across state lines brings a sentence of 10 years, but a white-collar criminal stealing millions of dollars may be sentenced to a year or less. Democratic Senator Joe Biden of Delaware spoke on the hesitancy of prosecutors to go after corporations.
There is a reluctance to go after the XYZ hospital, which is sometimes the biggest employer. And I wonder whether or not that plays.
The senator also inquired about what changes the government can implement to enable law enforcement to go after white-collar criminals.
Should we be out there saying, we want to enhance your budget so that we are going to increase the funding that provides you the ability to hire X number more prosecutors, investigators, or accountants, and the various technical people you need in order to be able to pursue white-collar crime.
Several witnesses from the Enron fallout who testified strongly suggested that the severity of the penalties for white-collar offenses should match the severity of the crimes. For Free Speech Radio News at the Capitol, I'm Ellen Ratner.
Venezuelan businessman Pedro Carmona is reportedly visiting the United States. Carmona gained international fame in April during a failed coup attempt when he served as Venezuela's president for a few hours. Josh Chaffin has more from Washington.
An unidentified U.S. official tells Reuters Pedro Carmona arrived in Miami this week, but that he'll likely leave the country before his short-term visa expires. Carmona was granted exile in Colombia 2 weeks ago. A former oil company executive, Carmona has close ties to the Bush administration. The British newspaper The Observer reported in April the attempted military overthrow of Venezuela's leftist president Hugo Chavez was closely tied to senior officials in the U.S. government, many of them veterans of the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s. Former President Carter says he may visit Venezuela to help avoid another coup attempt. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Further violence in the Middle East today as another suicide bombing killed seven Israelis and injured dozens of others, as Israeli forces moved into key West Bank cities and the leadership contemplates a military reoccupation of the West Bank until they've determined that the suicide bomber threat has been neutralized. Awad Dawabi's reports from Ramallah.
Israeli journalist sources are talking about a quick, fast and a strong strike against the Palestinian Authority. The objective of this strike shall be the headquarters of Arafat in Ramallah, and it will be the arrest of several aides of Arafat and deporting them out of the country. Palestinian side, no official reaction till now on this suicide attack, but the Palestinian population is very afraid. Indeed, last night and this morning, Israeli tanks entered the city of Nablus and reoccupied also the whole city of Qalqilya and Jenin in the northern of the West Bank, and several persons were arrested. 1 hour ago, a huge confrontation, armed confrontation took place in the city of Qalqilya between armed persons and between Israeli army. One Israeli officer and one soldier were killed, and one Palestinian also was killed in this confrontation. And no further details on this accident in Qalqilya, but in Ramallah now the roads are empty and everyone is at his home waiting the new Israeli attack and the new Israeli occupying of the city.
Free Speech Radio News' Awad Dawabes reporting. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle.
"40 acres and a mule" was the unkept promise made to African Americans during the Reconstruction period following the Civil War, which freed them. More than a century later, as the push for reparations continues to grow and gain support, and lawsuits are being filed against companies that profited from slavery, there is a move at the federal level to consider the feasibility of reparations. The bill is authored by House Democrat John Conyers, who testified before the New York City Council today, asking councillors to pass a resolution to support his bill. We spoke with him just before he testified. Congressman Conyers, on this important day of celebrating Juneteenth, why do you support reparations for descendants of slavery?
Well, I think it's a commitment that was made in the Congress at that period of time, just after the Civil War, that has never been kept. It's also a way to bring closure to one of the deepest social questions in American history, and that is the incredibly long time that one set of human beings were held in bondage inside the United States with the approval and cooperation of their own government.
You've authored a bill that calls for Congress to study the feasibility of paying reparations. This bill passed or was supported in the Chicago City Council. You're now about to go into the New York City Council and pitch this bill. Can you tell us about the bill?
It calls for a federal commission to do what has never been done in American history, and that is to study the feasibility of a reparations as it might apply to the descendants of those who have been held in bondage in the United States. We also have legislators from the state legislature in New York who are doing the same thing there. And this is going on all over the country in Chicago, Detroit, and dozens of other cities. The same resolutions are in the nature of supporting these resolutions have occurred. Now, all this is about building up understanding and appreciating why it is we're doing what we are.
Tell us about the feasibility of paying reparations.
It's as feasible as anything else, but we're not sure if this is going to take a solution in the term of payment if you're talking about money. We're studying whether reparations is appropriate. The next issue that comes after that is what form would it take? And I must say that there are many opinions about this. The notion that this is a search for a compensation in cash is not unanimous by any extent. And so that's what we will come to after we study the feasibility of reparations. We assume that that may be positively resolved, and then we get to the question of what form should it take.
Congressman Conyers, what do you hope to achieve today in the New York City Council?
By their going along, and I trust that they will, with resolutions that support the work that I've introduced at the national level, we begin to get the awareness of our citizenry about the significance, purpose, goals, and objectives of a call for a legislative commission to examine reparations. Until we do that, and this is not just for black people, this is for all Americans. But not too far from here, black people stood at ground zero. Not too far from ground zero are the first African slave burial grounds in which some of our ancestors are interred. So there's a connection between acts of terror now and acts of terror earlier in history.
Congressman John Conyers, representative of Michigan, thank you very much for joining us on Free Speech Radio News.
Ms. Fernandez, it's a pleasure.
The legacy of slavery continues to inflict many African Americans with poor schools, a drug plague, high rates of prison incarceration, and racially isolated neighborhoods. Prior to World War II, New York's Long Island was mostly farmland and a few resort communities. At the end of World War II, with an influx of returning veterans seeking the fulfillment of the American dream and affordable living accommodations, there was a severe housing shortage. Responding to this demand, builder William Levitt introduced prefabricated cookie-cutter homes to communities in Pennsylvania and on Long Island. These areas soon became the prototype of the new American suburb. However, as Dred Scott Keyes reports from New York, a new study says Long Island has developed into the most segregated suburb in the United States.
According to Andrew Beveridge, a professor of sociology at Queens College and an expert on the demographics of New York City and Long Island, the development of Levittown, while satisfying the needs of returning white servicemen from World War II, was closed to African Americans and other people of color through the use of a contractual racial covenant.
The deed said that no member of the Negro or other races can own this property. They didn't tell a black person that they couldn't move there. In fact, their other Levittown, the one in Pennsylvania, was ultimately sued. And it was sued, and they ultimately had to do open housing in the Levittown in Pennsylvania. But that never happened in the Levittown in New York. And the Levittown in New York, to this day, hardly has any blacks.
Today, blacks make up less than 1% of that community's population. Beveridge says that along with the use of racial covenants throughout the island, the federal government also helped to shape segregation on the 110-mile stretch of land.
One of the criteria for home mortgages, if you're going to get an FHA or veteran mortgage, one of the criteria was, is the neighborhood white? So if the neighborhood wasn't white, you know, it was harder for you to get a mortgage in that area. In effect, these very potent institutional patterns pushed for the segregation.
I call it the Black Belt. Sections of Freeport going into Roosevelt, then into Uniondale, and going into Hempstead. That is all basically on Nassau Road and Main Street in those four communities.
Diana Coleman has been a community activist from Roosevelt for the past 27 years. She was the leading plaintiff in a lawsuit against Nassau County, which forced that local government to reassess every home in Nassau.
That must be done by the assessor's office of Nassau County. It's going to cost a couple of $1 million, actually about $40 million, but that's a small price to pay based on the amount of grievance that Nassau County has had to pay over the years. That's part of the reason why Nassau County is in such fiscal problems. They pay out more than $400 million in the last 3 years.
The recent study of Long Island's pattern of segregation was sponsored by the Long Island Community Foundation through their working organization, ERACISM, an acronym for Education, Research, Advocacy, and Support to Eliminate and End Racism. The one-year-old group is dedicated to getting to the root of racist practices on Long Island. Fred Brewington is a member of ERACISM. He says the island's black communities have been pegged from the very beginning to remain apart from white communities.
Those communities have been the target, essentially, of such phenomenon as both redlining and predatory lending and steering, all of which have added to the separate communities that are rather stark by race.
Some Long Island residents and advocacy groups like the American Civil Liberties Union have used the courts as an effective tool to eliminate institutional racism. Hempstead, for example, was forced to change when lawsuits accused white political leaders as being unresponsive to the needs of the African American population, which was already underrepresented. And currently, there's a court-ordered redrawing of state senatorial district lines. But due to the segregated nature of Nassau County, says Professor Beveridge, politicians are trying to dilute the black vote.
If they would keep the minority community together, one of those seats would be in a district with 55% minority. And instead of doing that, they have chosen to split that minority community up into four different districts, none of which then has more than about 20% minority. So that then dilutes the power of the black and Latino community.
In recent years, there's been a large influx of Latinos from various parts of the Americas. Ruington says these groups usually move into black areas and that their future is directly wed with that of African Americans.
The communities are geographically compact with one another and are also politically cohesive, which is interesting on Long Island. With regard to voting and electing and being involved in terms of issues, those two communities have and continue to be linked hand in hand and shoulder to shoulder in trying to push this mammoth boulder out of the way, which is the boulder of segregation and discrimination.
While Detroit, Milwaukee, and Chicago remain America's most segregated cities, Long Island's black and Latino populations are seeking redress and relief from years of discrimination through a myriad of lawsuits. However, due to the prevalence of redlining, realtor steering practices, unwritten racial covenants, and gerrymandering, a change in Long Island's demographics will be a slow and often painful process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
In the early morning hours of July 23, 1999, police in Tulia, Texas, raided trailers and public housing units, arresting residents accused of selling cocaine to an undercover mole. The culmination of an 18-month sting operation in conjunction with the Panhandle Narcotics Task Force, police arrested 43 people, 40 of whom were black, more than 10% of the town's black community. The charges were false, and most observers now believe the undercover mole provided the cocaine. Reporter Robert Knight takes a look at Tulia 2 years later.
New York-based attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler has been following developments in Texas, both as president of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice and as an honorary marshal and judge of this week's Juneteenth parade in Amarillo, Texas.
An enormous percentage of the black population was arrested on the word of a single informant who proved to be most dubious. And most recently, in the case of Tanya White, whose case was dismissed, was proven that Tanya White was not even in the place that he happened to say she was. And in fact, the case was dismissed against her. She is going to bring a lawsuit against him. And it is just another nail in the coffin of the 2 year convictions that have already occurred merely on his say-so.
This month's vindication in a Texas courtroom came nearly a year after hundreds of legal and civil rights activists marked the anniversary of the arrests with a rally and candlelight march on Tulia's City Hall.
We have gathered because we believe a great injustice has been perpetrated, and we will continue to speak out because it is our right as Americans to say what we believe without embarrassment or fear.
Here in the darkness, in front of City Hall, candles, lighters, flashlights are being lit, bringing a new brightness to this Tulia night, where 46 people were indicted, convicted, or accepted plea bargains, tantamount to guilty, because of a runaway drug sting operation spearheaded by one Tom Coleman, using extraordinarily unorthodox and undocumented methods, his word held up in court against those he targeted after being given a list of alleged drug participants by the local sheriff.
To me, they was targeted at all blacks, I mean, and all young blacks, really. And, you know, I mean, it ain't like we dumb. We knew he was the police. He just say, can I get some crack? And he a white man that we don't know. I mean, it ain't like we was dumb. But a lot of my homeboys was arrested, and when they came to jail, they told me about it. I mean, and all they could say is, man, we couldn't put no clothes on, man. They had us out in boxes. The TV news was already there. And then my girl write me a letter when I'm in jail and tell me that the housing authority done already sent them eviction notice. I mean, it was like it was all one day. I mean, how would everything go that fast if they didn't have it planned? I mean, they wouldn't even let people put their clothes on. And they walking on TV news in boxes, hair messed up, no shirt, no shoes, no socks. I mean, you should have seen how that made them feel. I mean, that's just like taking your manhood.
when friends by shame are undefiled, how can I keep from singing?
The essence of the celebration of Juneteenth is a struggle against racism, and it celebrates the most significant victory this country has had against racism, and that was the abolition of slavery. But unfortunately, many aspects of slavery still exist, and one of those aspects is the racist way in which the drug laws are enforced against black people in this country. 90% of the drug prisoners in this country are black, and we also know that 90% of the drug abusers and users in this country are not black, but are a majority of white people, and if we had equal enforcement of laws, they would generally respect the breakdown of the population as opposed to isolating black people as drug abusers and sellers.
There have been changes in Texas since the Tulia sweep of 1999, including legislation requiring more than the mere word of an undercover agent for drug convictions. Meanwhile, Ratner Kunstler sees significance in the fact that while Texas was one of the last states to admit the end of slavery, it was also the first to make Juneteenth an official holiday. I'm Robert Knight for Free Speech Radio News.
On this Juneteenth special, we go to our commentator from Death Row, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Why kids flunk history. The great French writer Voltaire once said, "There is no history, only fictions of various degrees of plausibility." Most historians would react angrily to that wry observation of the great French philosopher and satirist Voltaire. Of course there's history, they would argue. But if a recent report of the U.S. Department of Education is to be believed, then millions of American school students, for all intents and purposes, there is no history. This is not to say that there are not history classes or perhaps millions of history books issued to junior high or high school kids all over this vast, wealthy nation. But history is not a formal course, nor a thing, an artifact, like a book. If it is not in the minds of millions of youngsters, for then and for them, it does not exist. According to published reports, the Education Department study found levels of historical knowledge that one member of the test governing board, historian Diane Ravitch, called truly abysmal. The study found, among other things, that of a majority of the tested students, some 29,000 fourth, eighth, and 12th graders, 57% could not handle history at a basic level, 32% were at basic, 10% were at grade level, and only 1% were at advanced levels. Let's put it another way, 89% of U.S. students at junior and senior high school ages could not meet the requirements of American history at their own grade level. What does this mean? Why can't Jamila or Jimmy or Jesus learn? I think these are improper questions. The questions should be no more than this. Why can't we teach Jamila, Jimmy, or Jesus history? The study gives some ideas. 54% of those who taught junior and senior high school kids in 1996...
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Neither majored nor minored in history, according to the U.S. Education Department. How can a teacher teach what he or she doesn't know? That's the beginning of a question. We must begin to teach a history of resistance, a popular history, a history of real people to real people. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Award-winning poet and UC Berkeley professor June Jordan died of breast cancer this past Friday. Jordan was widely admired for her passionate and often political poetry. She was 65. Christopher Martinez and KPFA's Flashpoints program produced this report.
We are alive. We've been waiting for.
Our own shadows disappear as the feet of thousands by the tens of thousands pound the fallow land into new dust.
Poet, activist, professor, June Jordan was one of the most prolific African-American writers in history. Ms. Magazine called her one of America's fiercest literary figures and social activists. 40 years of activism fueled by flawless art, that's how Nobel laureate Toni Morrison described the career of June Jordan. Writer Alice Walker was a longtime friend of Jordan. When journalist Dennis Bernstein interviewed her for KPFA's Flashpoints program, she described what made Jordan such a powerful poet.
She couldn't be lied to, which is such a wonderful quality. She always saw for herself. If necessary, she would go to the very place of evil to see exactly what was happening. And she really couldn't be silenced, and she couldn't be frightened. Or if she was frightened, she went on anyway. She was a great poet.
Although she's best known as a poet, she also published volumes of essays, novels, a column for the Progressive magazine, song lyrics, the libretto for an opera, and children's books, including a biography of Fannie Lou Hamer. As an academic, she taught English at more than 7 universities and colleges, including Yale University. Since 1989, she taught at the University of California at Berkeley, where she was professor of African American Studies. It was at Berkeley that she founded Poetry for the People, which she called a program for the political and artistic empowerment of students. With its blend of poetry, political and community activism, and education, Poetry for the People may be the most fitting tribute to Jordan's life. Junichi Sumitsu was a student in the program.
Up to the very final moments, June was always fighting for Poetry for the People, for the continuation of this program. I think that we will definitely continue to celebrate June's life by going forth and speaking the truth.
Fellow student Maria Poblet describes how Jordan taught not only how to write poetry, but how to use poetry.
She knew that if she took us very seriously, we would take ourselves very seriously. And that's how she taught us to approach poetry, and that's how she taught us to approach the movement for our liberation, with discipline and with love.
For Poblet, Jordan's teaching and poetry, like her political activism, were tools for leading a moral life in society.
June taught us that the poet needs to seek out and discover the truth and defend it. And she really taught us that culture is a weapon for liberation, and that what you need to say is important. June trained us since the day she met every one of us for this moment. She was training us to take over. She was, you know, and now it's our turn. She kept pushing us to find the truth and to find what we could do to show our love for the truth and for one another and to really create solidarity.
Alice Walker says Jordan's connection with her students was vital to her poetry and activism.
She was a poet who was very much connected to what was going on with the young, especially with you know, all people. But she had a deep commitment to her students, and she was always looking at whatever was happening in the world in relation to how it would impact young people. And so if she could figure out a way to speak up or to act as a way of making change, she did. And it was not just in words. She was not just the poet who wrote, but the poet who also, you know, stormed the gates.
I was born a black woman.
June Jordan's final book of essays will be published in September. Its title, Some of Us Did Not Die. For Free Speech Radio News in Berkeley, this is Christopher Martinez.
And where are my loved ones? It is time to make our way home.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.